Most of us love a little trip away, a chance to remove ourselves from the hustle and bustle of everyday life. Very recently, the British government have been pushing for Brits to commit to what has been branded a staycation, a vacation that remains within the Isles of Britain. There are, of course, options to go camping. There are holiday homes, villas, caravan parks, and more. Although, I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of the time we spend away is in hotels. Hotels and motels are two of the most obvious settings for a scary story, popping up often with the confounds of murderous tales and creepy goings-on. This is due to several factors. There is a vulnerability to the knowledge that strangers that work within the building have access to your room with ease, to the fact that you do not know the building or even the room very well. And that's not even to mention the fact that you have no idea who was staying in that room mere hours before, nor what they may have left behind. My name is Luke Mordew, and this urban legend is The Body in the Hotel. There are numerous urban legends in connection to hotel rooms, making this episode slightly different to those that have come before it. This time, rather than uncovering one particular tale, we will be looking into several that may or may not prove themselves to be, in fact, true, rather than the urban legends that we perhaps hoped they would be. Firstly, let's get some of the smaller and more commonly spread urban legends out of the way before we begin our story. One of the tamer urban legends is more American-based than worldwide, with word of mouth spreading the apparent fact that money is kept in hotel Bibles, placed there as a reward for reading it. This is, unfortunately, not true, with some believing its persistence to exist is perpetrated to ensure that those staying in the rooms find the Bible at hand. I can imagine, even if it was true, the cleaners would be cleaning out the pages of the Bible as well. Another is the belief that hotel key cards contain your personal information upon them, and anyone with a particular scanner can read and steal your details. This is, of course, also untrue, as the chips within key cards are so simplistic that the information that they hold is almost entirely limited to the minor abilities required for the room. One of the most famous hotel-based urban legends is one that I've already delved into with great depth in the third episode of Season 1, titled The Kidney Heist, which tells the story of a man who wakes up in a bathtub of a hotel room, only to find that his kidney has been removed to be sold onto the black market. Another, more troubling urban legend is one that stems from common sense and general consumer expectation. This one says that bedbugs are usually found more often in cheaper or budget hotels over the higher end. Unfortunately, no matter how much you spend on your hotel room, you are just as likely or unlikely to come across bedbugs, no matter where it is you are staying. There is one that sounds like scaremongering, very urban legend-like in its existence, and yet it is completely true. This one is the idea that you should not be posting about your holiday before or during your trip. If you're away with your significant other, your family, or even if you live alone, you are letting any opportunist know that you will be so far from home that you will not be returning for at least a week. This makes sense as, growing up, my parents and many others left a light on in the landing or a radio playing to create the illusion that somebody was indoors whilst we were away, only for the internet to completely disregard this precaution, instead announcing to the world that we were leaving. One legend is not even limited to just hotels, and yet sounds so strange to those who do not believe in the supernatural that it almost feels as though it should be an urban legend. And that is the very true fact that there is a widespread fear in the hotel world of the infamous 13th floor. For this reason, any hotel higher than 13 usually jumps from 12 to 14. Although, let's face it, if you're on floor 14, you know where you really are. Some of these you may have already known. Others you may be hearing for the first time. Or perhaps they simply reassured the thoughts you already had in your mind. But then, there are those stories that sound so strange, dark, and horrifying that we tell ourselves that surely they could never have truly happened. And yet, they did. In my telling of the story, we will follow Barry and Shirley, an aging British couple who have travelled to Las Vegas for a week away to celebrate their 25th wedding anniversary. The day had been long, tiring and stressful for Shirley and Barry, who had gotten up extra early to make their way from London to Las Vegas. They knew it was going to be a long-haul journey, and yet Shirley was frustrated to find that Barry complained at what she considered to be every step of the way. On the other hand, Barry was also frustrated as to him, Shirley had made things difficult every step of the way. This was a constant in the couple's lives, and always had been, with their daughter jokingly telling them that their love language was bickering. In truth, no matter how much they irritated each other, they wouldn't know what to do without the other. It had been 35 long years since the moment they said their vows, and this was to be the honeymoon that they never were able to have before, finally bringing their dream to life. They were now standing by the front desk whilst a pretty young woman on the other side began to sort out their check-in, maintaining a strong smile to ensure that the couple were receiving a warm American welcome, something that Barry was very happy to receive. After his long flight and grumpy attitude, it seems getting a smile from an attractive woman would give him an extra little spring in his step, which did not go unnoticed by Shirley as Barry joked with the woman whilst taking their key card. They began to walk towards the elevator, pulling their luggage behind them, causing Barry to let out a tired sigh. "Oh, I see," Shirley said with a tut. "It's all smiles of Miss American Pie back there, but when it's just me and you, you're grumbling." Barry laughed, slightly amused but mostly annoyed, cutting back at her as he replied, "I was being polite. You should give it a go sometime." But before he could even turn back to focus on the elevators in front of him, Shirley had asked, "And what's that supposed to mean?" But before their bickering could continue any further, they were stopped by a smartly dressed young man who quite clearly had been awkwardly trying to get their attention for a while. He offered to take their bags and suitcases for them, which they gleefully accepted, stepping into the lift with the young man feeling more free now they didn't have to pull any of their belongings around. Once the elevator pinged and the doors opened to the long hallway of the hotel rooms, they began to make their way to theirs. The walls were filled with beautiful paintings, placed between stunning light fixtures that added an element of glitz and glam to the area. One of the main reasons the two chose this hotel to begin with, wanting a taste of that real, big and bold Las Vegas experience. At least, when they're more awake and hydrated. The porter politely took the key from Shirley with a charming smile before unlocking it for them, stepping into the room with their suitcases. Barry held the door open, allowing Shirley to enter first with a grand wave of his arm, playing up to how posh they felt. But as they entered to admire the beauty of their new temporary place to sleep, they were hit with a strange, overpowering smell. Shirley looked over to the porter, who had hesitated for a moment before placing the suitcases beside the bed. "Excuse me, am I going crazy or does this room smell funny?" Shirley asked the porter as he awkwardly stood up straight. He hesitated for a moment once again, clearly not wanting to disagree with the couple, but also not wanting to play down his employers. Luckily for him, before he could even reply, Barry clumsily chimed in with, "Smells like crap in here. Do you reckon you can have a word?" The porter nodded before pacing towards them, replying, "Not to worry, I'll go speak to my manager and get it sorted for you. Just hang tight here." He stepped past them, heading to the hotel room door, closing it behind him.
"I think I hacked in."
"We're on the air?"
"Shh, security's outside."
"But how's my hair?"
"It's a radio station."
"Psst, psst. You guys hear about the Beyond the Shadows podcast with Ryan and Scott?"
"You guys into paranormal?"
"What about true crime?"
"How about UFOs and cryptids?"
"We also have mad hauntings."
"We got security."
"No, we don't. We're not big enough to need it yet."
"No, we got security."
"Hey, what are you guys doing? Get out of here!" Listen to the Beyond the Shadows podcast.
Beyond the Shadows.
Barry sighed again before sniffing the air, stepping deeper into the room. "What is that?" he rhetorically asked. "You're supposed to tip him," Shirley suddenly blurted out in a nervous realization. Barry turned to her with a confused look in his eye. "It's all right, the job wasn't done yet." "He's a porter. His job's to bring the bags up, which he did, and we didn't tip him," she replied, turning to the bedroom door as if she was contemplating running after him. "He literally ran off, Shirley. What do you want me to do?" Barry replied as he sat down onto the bed. "Over here, if you don't tip somebody, it's about as bad as slapping them in the face," she exclaimed, working herself up in guilt. Barry tutted, thinking to himself for a minute before muttering, "Great. Well, they're not going to help us now, are they?" He got to his feet and walked past Shirley, putting his hand on her shoulder in reassurance before heading into the bathroom and locking the door behind him. Shirley studied the room for a moment before finally stepping further inside, placing her fingers under her nostrils to soften the smell ever so slightly as she began to slowly open the cupboards and search for the cause of the odor. But she found nothing that seemed to be the culprit. She called out to Barry again, asking him if the smell was coming from inside the bathroom, to which he childishly replied, "Not yet," with a gleeful snigger under his breath, causing her to tut, shaking her head as she walked towards the large windows that overlooked the wide open space of Las Vegas, filled with life and colorful chaos. She admired it for a moment. Sure, she was tired and grouchy, and sure, the hotel room smelt terrible, but she was finally here. After years of dreaming about it, and with the man she loved of all people. With this, she began to feel calmer, finally able to slow down and really appreciate all that was happening. This gentle moment was sharply interrupted by the sudden ringing of the phone beside the bed. She answered it to find it was the young woman at the front desk on the other end. Shirley was relieved to be told that if they were to come down to the hotel bar, they would receive a complimentary drink whilst their room is given a good once-over to ensure the smell is gone. Shirley agreed and thanked her for her help before putting the phone down. As she did, Barry walked back into the room, fastening his belt, asking her who it was on the other end of the phone. She explained the situation to him, now feeling the peace and tranquility that comes with a holiday. Barry didn't seem to be quite there yet, as he instantly replied, "Well, that's not good enough. They should be supplying us with a new room." It wasn't that Shirley disagreed with him. It was just that she had now decided that she was on holiday and was going to enjoy every moment. So she simply told Barry to shut up and go down and get a drink. Barry and Shirley spent the next half an hour sitting at a table in the bar with a cocktail each in front of them. Shirley sat watching the world go by outside, admiring the similarities and differences between the Americans and the British, whilst Barry scanned through a brochure he had found on the way down, pointing out all the things he'd like to see whilst they were there. It was nice for Shirley to see Barry relax a little, now finally showing excitement again for the holiday, joining her in vacation mode as he switched off from travel mode. As Shirley smiled at her husband, watching him scan the pictures in front of him, she noticed a tall man in a sharp suit walking towards them with a large, apologetic smile, clasping his hands together in a somewhat nervous fashion. "Mr. and Mrs. Watkins?" he asked as he arrived, to which Barry replied, "That's us," spinning in his chair with eagerness. The man explained that he was the manager of the hotel and that he had personally seen to it that the room was completely overhauled and is now ready for them to use. With excitement, the couple got to their feet and thanked the manager before heading back up to the 14th floor. As they entered the room, they were hit with the smell of cleaning products, bleach and spray, which, although it was an improvement on what was there before, was still slightly overpowering for the couple. Shirley walked straight to the window and opened it, although it only cracked open ever so slightly as a protective lock blocked it. "Great," Barry remarked as he slumped down onto the bed, resting his head onto the pillow. "It's gone from smelling like a morgue to smelling like a hospital." Shirley sighed, this time smirking as she picked up a pillow before throwing it at Barry with, "I'll stop bloody complaining and get the tea bags out of the suitcase, will ya?" An hour later, the smell had subsided and Shirley was having a much-needed hot shower in the bathroom. Barry, on the other hand, was flicking through the American channels on the TV whilst laying on the bed. He couldn't be certain it wasn't just in his head, But he could have sworn that with the fading of the cleaning product's aroma, the mysterious foul odor had begun to seep its way back into the room. He sat up, noticing that there seemed to be a slight waft of the foul stench every time he moved. This made him question whether it was, in fact, coming from the bed. With this thought, he picked up a pillow and sniffed it, but it smelled absolutely fine, fresh and clean. Next, he would try the sheets, but they also smelled fine. It wasn't until he leant down to smell the underlay that he began to question it further. The fabric itself did not smell, although the closer he got to the mattress, the stronger the smell seemed to get. He jumped to his feet, now on a mission to finally figure out what was going on once and for all. He grabbed the pillows and dropped them on the floor before pulling the sheets from the bed, sniffing them in his hands. Once confirming that it all seemed clean, he let go, also dropping them to the floor. It was at this moment the bathroom door opened to reveal Shirley, who stepped out with a towel on her head and a soft dressing gown wrapped around her still wet body. The sight of what looked to be Barry pulling the room apart instantly halted any tranquility Shirley was in the midst of, as she stopped in her tracks before claiming, "What the hell are you doing?" He told her the smell was coming from the bed and that he was already fed up with this holiday, which she replied to with quite understandable upset. He grabbed hold of the mattress and began to yank, exclaiming, "I should have just stayed at home," causing Shirley to remark in her frustration, "I wish you had at this rate." But in an instant, any words that they had said to each other were rendered meaningless, as Shirley let out a sudden yelp of a scream, looking down at the bed. Barry stood with the mattress held up in front of him, frozen in shock and horror, as he too looked down at the bed frame, finally finding the source of the foul odor. Hiding in the darkness of the room was the bruised body of a decomposing corpse that had been hidden within the base of the bed. To those that have heard this story before, it does seem to fit the perfect criteria for an urban legend. It is outlandish enough that it is noteworthy, gruesome enough that it is cringeworthy, and dark enough that it is unnerving. Although, with this, it is also just about realistic enough to make us ponder on its authenticity, questioning whether this was an urban legend or a real-life occurrence. I fell into the camp of believing this to be merely another urban legend, perhaps hardened by my research over the past year, leading me to often conclude that these stories are nothing but that, stories. Although, every now and then something crops up that surprises me, and on this occasion, that very much seemed to be the case. In much of my research into urban legends, a name that pops up almost every time is the folklorist Jan Harold Brunvard, that I have mentioned several times before in the series. He is, to many, the master of understanding urban legends with his book, The Vanishing Hitchhiker, a book that did very much what we do here back in 1981. It is in his book, The Baby Train, that he writes that he first heard the body found in a hotel room legend back in 1991, with every version that came to him mentioning a Las Vegas hotel. At the time, though, there was a complete lack of verifiable evidence, which led him to believe that this was, in fact, nothing more than a story. Much like an urban legend, the tale was repeatedly altered as those that shared the gruesome tale misremembered and changed certain aspects of it, leading to many of the variations turning into untrue accounts by the very nature in which they were spread. Although, it seems the foundation to which this legend sprung from were real news accounts, with the information only shifting location to suit the narrative of whoever the storyteller was at the time. So let's now begin our travels into the true accounts in the dark world of the body in the hotel. The earliest recorded encounter that I could find was in the year of 1982. It was here that Gary Smith, Richard Kuklinski, and Daniel Deppner worked together to run a slew of thefts. After one of the previous members, Percy House, had agreed to become an informant on the comings and goings of Richard Kuklinski, more commonly known as the Iceman, tensions had begun to run high. Once warrants were issued for Daniel Deppner and Gary Smith, Kuklinski urged both the men to lay low and rented them a room at the York Motel in North Bergen, New Jersey. Gary Smith would claim that he was now looking to go straight, leaving a life of crime behind, and fearing that Gary too would become an informant, Kuklinski decided it was necessary for him to die. He would later present Gary Smith with a hamburger for him to eat, which he did, unknowingly ingesting the cyanide that the Iceman had laced it with. Although this proved to be slow work and, growing impatient, Daniel Deppner finished him off by strangulation with a lamp cord. When they realized that Daniel's wife was not coming of the car to help move the body, they improvised, simply placing the corpse between the mattress and the box springs, where he would stay for several days. Over the coming nights, the room was rented out to a number of patrons, many of whom had mentioned to the motel staff that there was a strange smell in the air, although not one of them thought to look under the bed. Finally, after the complaints continued for some time, the motel manager decided it was time to investigate themselves, and it was only here that the decomposing body of Gary Smith was finally found. In the year of 1987, amongst the lands of Rosedale, Maryland, an unidentified man died of a drug overdose after one of the 34 balloons filled with heroin he had swallowed to keep safe had burst inside of him. Rather than seeking help or reporting the incident, his partner instead decided to stash the corpse under the motel bed before leaving. It was 3 days later that a family rented the room, only to find the odor was horrific and disturbing, leading to the eventual discovery of the body. Only a year later, in the year of 1988, another body was found in the box springs of a bed. It was at the Oceanside Motel in Long Island, USA, that the corpse of 29-year-old Mary Jean de Oliveira was found days after she had died after renters had complained about the smell in the room. It is reported that at least two guests unknowingly slept on the same bed with the body before it was found, with at least one patron refusing to stay in the room due to the smell. It was only a few days later that the murderer was caught after an employee at the Oceanside Motel tipped off the police that they recognized the man that had checked in with Mary before she had died. It was a good thing they did, as when the police finally caught up with 49-year-old Cornelius Wolves, he was found to already be holding a 26-year-old woman captive in the back of the car. Another occasion was a slight alteration to the events. It was not a guest who unknowingly stayed with the body in the room, but the killer themselves. It was in Virginia in the year of 1989 that 27-year-old Deidre Smith was discovered under the floor of a motel room. A month later, in another motel, 29-year-old Marilyn Graham would be found under the bed. Both of these women were victims to the same twisted man, Jerry Lee Dunbar, who decided to remain in the same room that he had hidden Deidre Smith inside for another 3 to 4 weeks. The bodies, as has been consistent with these events, were eventually found when the next patron entered the room and complained about the foul odor inside. In 1994, a frustrated German tourist complained about the smell in his room at the Traveler's Hotel near Miami International Airport, which would lead to the discovery of a 24-year-old Josefina Martinez's body. Strangely enough, the next case of this occurrence was in the same year, in the same state, with the complaint once again coming from a German tourist and his wife. This would lead the staff at the Fort Lauderdale to discover the body of a 47-year-old Brian Gregory, who had been tucked away under the platform bed. It was as recent as 2010 that Sony Millbrook failed to pick up her children from school, leading her family to file a missing persons report on January 27th in Memphis, Tennessee. It wasn't until 47 days later, on the 15th of March, that investigators were called to the room in a budget motel that Sony had been living in prior to her disappearance. Inside, they had discovered her body within the frame of the bed, even though the room had been cleaned and rented out several times over the course of the 6.5 weeks since her disappearance. Finally, in 2014, a jury convicted the father of four of Sony's children, Lakeith Moody, of first-degree murder. With these horrifying, tragic, and disturbing accounts happening up and down the states of America before and after the first tellings of the legend, it is clear that, although the story that is often shared may be fictional, the heart of the legend is very much true. As mentioned before, this is but one of many urban legends in regards to hotels and their guests. But the story of the body under the bed is only one of two tales that I found that sound so urban legend-like in their story, and yet are true. And the other is the tragic tale of Elisa Lam. In a recent survey, almost 50% of podcasters said they get stuck promoting their show. And with over 4 million podcasts in circulation, standing out from the crowd has never been more important. That's why PodSpike exists. PodSpike offers indie podcasters pro-level marketing without the hefty price tag. The process is simple. Choose a different promotional power-up each month, and their team will get to work promoting your show. Choose from being featured in apps and newsletters, receiving influencer shoutouts, audience analysis, and more, all from just $99 a month. Visit podspike.com to sign up to their free newsletter and find out how they can help you promote your podcast. The first 10 listeners to use the code URBANLEGENDS, all one word, will get 20% off their first month of a PodSpike Pro membership. Offer ends 31st of March 2022. Did you know that we have nearly 20 extra episodes you haven't heard yet available right now on our Patreon? If you want to hear them, have your say on what legends we cover, join a community of individuals of similar interests, and get discounts on all future merchandise, then visit us on Patreon by simply searching patreon.com/urbanlegends or clicking the link in our show notes. You can join us as either a mythologist at £4 a month, an anthropologist at £8 a month, or as a folklorist at £15 a month. Each tier offers you more for your money, and every penny we receive goes straight back into the continued growth of this podcast. So, what are you waiting for? There's a whole world of legends back here that you're missing. And now, back to the legend. The Stay On Main Hotel of downtown Los Angeles, formerly known as the Cecil Hotel, hosts a wide net of dark stories in its history. Known for being the home of notorious serial killers, multiple murders, suicides, and overdoses over the years. But it was the events that unfolded in 2013 that brought its darkness into the world of mainstream media once again. Some of the guests that were staying at the hotel had begun to complain about low water pressure when trying to shower. On top of this was the issue of the water turning dark in its appearance with a very unusual taste when brushing their teeth. On February the 19th, a hotel maintenance worker by the name of Santiago Lopez would go to the top of the building and climb up to one of the four 1,000-gallon water tanks located upon it, as these tanks were feeding water across guest rooms, a kitchen, and a coffee shop. When Santiago looked down through the open hatch of the tank he had climbed, he would be horrified to see the dead face of the now famous Elisa Lam, floating naked in the dark water below. Elisa was a 21-year-old Chinese-Canadian studying at the University of British Columbia, whilst also living with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder and depression, things that she was undergoing treatment for. She would contact her parents every day whilst traveling on Amtrak and intercity buses to California. It was around this time that she would visit the San Diego Zoo, posting photographs she had taken there on her social media pages. On January 26th, she arrived in Los Angeles and checked into the Cecil Hotel, most likely drawn to it by its cheap pricing, ideal for a young student. During her stay, Elisa had a roommate. However, as the hotel's lawyers would later claim, she was moved to a room of her own as her roommate had complained about Elisa's odd behavior during their time together. She had reportedly also had an outburst in the hotel lobby, according to the hotel's manager at the time, Amy Price, suggesting that her mental health was waning. On the day of February the 1st, Elisa was due to check out of the Cecil Hotel and leave for Santa Cruz, but her parents did not receive their usual phone call. They would eventually contact the Los Angeles Police Department and fly out to LA to help once it had become clear that Elisa was in fact missing. The only person that claimed to see her on her final day was Katie Orphan, a manager at a bookstore that Elisa had entered, saying that she thought that Elisa was outgoing, very lively, very friendly. Once it was clear that her belongings, including her ID and medication, were left behind, completely intact in her hotel room, LAPD officials began to search the entire hotel and surrounding area with police dogs and search parties, to no avail. With no leads and no real understanding on what it is they had witnessed on their security footage, they released a segment of the day's elevator CCTV, one that showed Elisa acting erratic and strange. In the footage, Elisa can be seen exiting and entering the elevator repeatedly, gesturing and seemingly talking with someone in the hallway outside the elevator doors, and even sometimes seemingly hiding against the wall inside the elevator. This confusing and admittedly eerie-looking CCTV footage almost inevitably caused a frenzy amongst the internet sleuths around the world, going viral with rapid speed with millions of views across several sites. It would be shared amongst supernatural believers as a woman being haunted by something on the hunt. And I must confess that the way in which the footage looks and the way in which Elisa acts does emit an image often seen in horror films. The video would also be shared amongst armchair detectives in the true crime community as they began to dissect and attempt to understand who was hunting her just out of frame. Then there were the conspiracy believers who wanted to know exactly what the police had cut out and just who it was they were protecting. As somebody who lives with a mental health diagnosis myself, albeit far less severe than Elisa's, I understand the footage to show somebody having an episode of sorts. I have worked within the fields of mental health many times over the years, spending time studying and researching mental health conditions, as well as meeting individuals with the diagnosis, alongside psychotherapists and psychiatrists to further my understanding of the field. The moment I saw the footage, an episode is exactly what I understood it to be, long before I learnt of any diagnosis Elisa had. I say this merely to emphasize that I very much fall into the camp of those who watched the footage and saw a display of mental health problems. Regardless of what camp the audience of the CCTV fell into, it did nothing to help with the case at hand, as no leads came forward due to the fact that, as they would soon find out, Elisa never left the Cecil Hotel. Her body was found face up, with her clothes floating in the water beside her, with a report from the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office stating that there was no evidence of physical trauma of any kind, and the death itself was accidental. The toxicology report would later state that her body held a small quantity of alcohol and traces of her prescribed medication, although it has been noted that the concentration of the prescription drugs in her system indicated that she was under-medicating or had very recently stopped taking it completely. There were many who approached this information with an air of caution, with some refusing to accept this fairly straightforward tragic event had unfolded this way. Like most mysteries, it is the wonder that we enjoy, and although we work to find the truth behind these mysterious events, the fact will never be as exciting or satisfying as the mystery itself. This is very much why most do not fact-check an urban legend when they hear it, as if they did, the legends wouldn't spread like they do. There were aspects of the Elisa Lam case that seemed unanswered to many, understandably questioning just how she had gotten onto the roof, especially considering the top floor door and stairwell was locked and alarmed. On top of this, the lids to the tanks were supposedly locked also, and if she had gotten inside herself, how could she have closed the heavy lid shut behind her? It would soon become apparent that the roof could be accessed from the hotel's fire escape, as proven by a video that circulated on social media after Elisa's body had been found. This would have also explained why the police's sniffer dogs lost her scent by the window of the fire escape when searching for her. In regards to the heavy hatch doors of the tank that would be tough to open and impossible to close, the answer to that was simple and clear, as Santiago explained, that when he climbed the tank to look inside, the lid was open and had always been open, meaning she could have simply climbed in with ease. Perhaps the reason I found this story so urban legend-like in its tale is due to the fact that it was only 11 years prior to the event that a Japanese horror film by the name of Dark Water was released. This film tells the story of the spirit of a little girl who haunts a mother and daughter in a run-down apartment complex after falling into the water tank and drowning in the dark, where she would remain until her body was found. There is so much eeriness, mystery, sadness, and confusion to the case of Elisa Lam. For me, a mental health advocate, it is a tragic tale of a woman not getting the help that she never knew she needed. To others, it is a ghost story to send a shiver down your spine, resulting in numerous shows, books, columns, and documentaries being made about her tale and the story of the Cecil Hotel, spending hours on the mystery and mere minutes on the tragedy of the reality. Elisa Lam was one of the many deaths connected to the urban legends we cover. But as we delve into their histories and real-life experiences, it is our responsibility to remember that they were real people and their tragedies affected all around them.
Urban Legends is written and produced by Luke Mordew in association with Mordew Pictures. Original score by Billy Jupp with additional sounds from storyblocks.com. If you like what you've heard and want to hear more, make sure to click subscribe on your chosen podcast provider and delve into the mysteries of our previous and future episodes. If that's not enough for you, then join us on Patreon for hidden episodes, extra content, and a chance to vote on what legends we cover. To find out more, visit lrmordew.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at ULPodcast, on Instagram at urbanlegends.podcast, or on Facebook by simply searching Urban Legends Podcast.